Welcome to On Balance. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger. I'll be your guide as we explore the stories of today with the personalities impacting tomorrow. Welcome to On Balance. Well, I am very much looking forward to this conversation. I feel as if in my life, and as I hopefully mature and gain some level of wisdom, advocacy is becoming a much bigger part and role in my life to stand up and support those that are aware, that are living a life of awareness and doing something about it. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. We're going to be speaking with Kathleen Rogers, the president of EarthDay.org. Yeah, that Earth Day, which I know everyone knows. Earth Day boasts over 20, she boasts over 20 years of experience as an environmental attorney and advocate with a focus on international and domestic environmental policy and law. Her career spans senior roles at the National Audubon Society, the Environmental Law Institute, two U.S. Olympic organizing committees, prestigious law firms, and collaboration with various U.N. offices, notably as Chief Wildlife Counsel for the National Audubon Society. She spearheaded initiatives on international trade, migratory species, and biodiversity. She has been recognized for her contributions and was honored as one of 2010's top working mothers by Working Mother magazine and featured as a power player of the week on Fox News Sunday. Under her leadership, EarthDay.org has evolved into a globally recognized nonprofit operating year-round across 192 countries, embracing diverse constituencies, especially youth. She's an advisor and judge for a number of global prizes, including the annual Holt Prize, which awards $1 million to college teams who create companies that solve pressing issues. Kathleen is a graduate of the University of California at Davis School of Law, where she served as editor-in-chief of the Law Review and clerked in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. So, Kathleen, that's an incredible background that you boast. Let's go back to prior days. Tell me when sort of the advocacy bug, if that's what you call it, when did it get you? Was there something about your rearing as a young girl? Was there something in the family unit that speaking up and being aware of your sort of your surroundings was supported, was something that was promoted, and where you created or developed some level of opinion even as a child to be able to have a voice?
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes. Although raising my voice is an interesting thing because I was one of seven kids, so you had to raise your voice no matter what you were doing or nobody heard you. But I think my parents were both do-gooders in not in a super like obvious way. It wasn't like we had a boatload of money and they were giving it away or anything like that. But just generally as human beings, they were super generous with their thoughts and beliefs. And that clearly, you know, impacted all seven of us because we all have that bone in our body. My sister's a public defender, my brother's a legislator, and the rest of us are just, I'm a lawyer. You know, we're all, we're not 100% in the public interest world, but we're definitely mostly ride on the same plane of progressive thinking about how human beings treat each other, I think, for starters. And we're all nature lovers. My mom grew up on a farm, but my father grew up in New York City. And so I can't really explain that except that together they were really interested in introducing us to the planet. And I can't tell you the number of incidences growing up where my dad would be the only one in his world that was actively seeking out people that were different than he was to talk to. And maybe he just liked to talk, but he was an incredibly generous, spirited human being. I mean, really amazing. And so we all turned out like that, I must say.
That's fabulous context. And one, I think, for many to aspire to. You know, look, there's a difference, I think, between finding a voice and finding a place sort of at the table, whether that's the kitchen table at home or sort of in professional settings. And then it's even, I think, an extension beyond that to say, I think I have an opportunity. I also think I have the wherewithal to lead. And I'm wondering, was there a moment for you where, was it by accident? Was it by intention that you knew that you could sort of create something from from nothing and lead a vision and a mission of like-minded people? Where did that start from?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I was always a super hard worker. Even if I had a dumb job or whatever, I worked really hard at it. And I think I had zero intention or zero plan, no plan at all, most of my life to be anywhere in particular. So I did stuff as crazy as try out for the US luge team. Thank God I didn't make it or I'd be dead because I was so bad at it. But I did try. I mean, I could make it down, but you know, there's that lip on the top of the luge run that can take your head off. So, but I also, a friend of mine from the luge team, she and I opened a bakery in Lake Placid, New York, and we sold out every day. And I just had this, you know, weird, I had a lot of weird opportunities that I jumped at.
So let me ask you then, so what, how would you couch your relationship to fear?
The older I get, the smarter I get, and fear, you know, that part of your brain that controls that fear thing raises its ugly head often. Now that I have kids, it's a whole different story. But before then, I mean, I did a lot of out there stuff, like hiking and doing all the stuff in really dangerous places, like in Southeast Asia in the, you know, the early 90s. And I mean, but really, I was in China like a couple months after Tiananmen Square, and it was like completely nuts. And I've just found myself in a lot of odd places and been lucky enough to survive. I stayed fearless and foolish for maybe longer than your average person. And, you know, but I mean, if I listed all the things, it would be a long conversation about nutty things I've done, but I did it with the best intentions. I never was ever seeking out a thrill part of it. It was just kind of happened. You know, it just, I've done a lot of amazing things because other people suggested them to me and they sounded like a good idea at the time. but you know, eventually the older I got, and I had good jobs. I did political PR. I worked for the BBC in New York. I had a great job at the BBC. Worked for the International Olympic Committees or the organizing committees, and then ended up in doing a master's degree and law degree in California. But I wouldn't say I followed the traditional path. I mean, there are people that graduate from college and know they want to go to law school. I didn't even think about it. It never would have occurred to me. But one day I was like, oh, I think I'll be, it's like, what's her name from that movie, Legally Blonde. I woke up one day and said, oh, I think I'll go to law school.
You're Reese Witherspoon.
I swear to God, I just woke up and said, oh, that sounds like a good idea.
So would you say that you're an extrovert? I mean, through and through? Or?
I am a little bit. I am. I'll talk to anybody like my dad would. I'm always carry on conversations. But a lot of me, I need downtime away from people. And because I write a lot for Earth Day and I've written quite a bit throughout my life, those kinds of things take a personality that can also be pretty solitary. But I'd say that I'm split 50-50 the way maybe most of us are. We enjoy. I absolutely hate cocktail parties. I hate anything where I'm standing around talking to people about nothing or.
Noted. I will not send you an invite.
I just
a cocktail party.
I'm just don't do well. But I love having friends over and I love going to friends' houses and socializing. And again, I'll talk to just about anybody on the street. But again, a large part of, I think, anybody who has to be creative or has, you know, when you work hard, you need that time where you're not just you have to be solitary and you have to learn to be alone and really deeply thinking about the stuff you want to write about, or even when you're trying to lobby somebody or persuade somebody, you don't just rip in there and start doing it. You've got to actually step back, think about your audience, think about what you're trying to do, meet them where they are. I think if I had any skill in the world, and I probably don't have all that many, I mean, I'm a decent writer, but it's, I've learned to meet people where they are. And that has taught me a boatload and made me a lot of friends. And I'm good at that part. That's one of my skills, and it's completely genuine. It's not, phony. That's just part of who I am, is wanting to understand people. And it feels like a lost art, you know, in this crazy age we're living in right now, where
I agree
people are so argumentative. And I found myself recently, I call it like COVID related, but who knows what it's related, but to be less tolerant, which is too bad, because I don't remember being that way 4 or 5 years ago. I remember, you know, having friends from kind of all walks of life. And Earth Day, since we're talking about that, is the big tent, right? So we have the wildest assortment of people inside our tent. It's everybody. And in fact, I call Earth Day, people say, well, what are you about? And I say, we're about everybody else. We're about not the greenies, although they're there, but my job and our job at Earth Day, which is why I took this job, why I left a good job and came here on, it was because I deeply believed, and Dennis Hayes, the guy who started Earth Day, talked me into this. I deeply believe that they're, is a role, and a critically important role in the 21st century of bringing people together. And Earth Day is one of those things that, unless you're really looking for an argument, everybody loves. And so there was something really appealing to me, because at my previous job at National Audubon, my job was litigation and lobbying, right? So my whole job was arguing all the time, making my point. And I remember the U.S. trade rep. I have a daughter when she was younger. I ran into her. She was a U.S. trade rep and hard, tough woman. And I ran into her in a store, and I was holding a pink tutu for my daughter. And she said to me, that tutu doesn't go with you at all. What? Why do you have that thing? You know, like I was some kind of monster that was just out there beating her up all the time. She's like, wow, that's really incongruous to see you with a pink tutu. I'm like, it's for my child. But I remember thinking, gosh, you know, everybody views me or the job I'm in, and everybody in my field is constantly litigating, constantly fighting to get the rights of whatever it is, wildlife or people or whatever, adjudicated in a way that's favorable to them and not big business or the government or whoever. But there was something really appealing about having it, switching gears entirely and coming to Earth Day and making it about everybody else. And I think I also liked the part, because obviously while we run Earth Day, and we came out of the first organization that, I mean, Earth Day was created by Dennis Hayes and Gaylord Nelson, and we're the organization that came out of that. The other thing I call us is sort of the Tom Sawyer of the environmental movement, because we have to get, we can't do it ourselves. So we have to get everybody else to paint our fence. And that requires a lot of convincing. And so I took that skill of being sort of an advocate and turned it into Earth Day, into a place where we sort of ask the question of why not? Why can't you do that? Why, you know, we think this is great for you. And tons of people organize Earth Day events. Well, millions of people organize Earth Day events without us, but they use our theme, which is plastics this year. But I think our role is to just be there as facilitating whatever anybody wants. And most people want the right thing. That's what I've discovered. They want a clean community. They want their kids to be healthy. They don't want them to be exposed to pesticides or chemicals. So,
But we do live in a very politicized world, and I want to pivot to the environmental movement and the narrative. And I'd love your perspective on sort of where do we stand? Are we, have we passed a threshold where we're entering into white noise? It feels as if communities across the country, especially in the U.S., there's a level of apathy to participate in their local communities in ways maybe that we, you know, in a perfect world, they would be more active, I guess, is maybe a better way to put that, because it isn't about discourse and conversation and learning. It's about having a position. And if you don't have a position, then you don't, I guess, have an opportunity to participate, at least in the current environment that we're in. And so could you sort of chalk the field a bit and I guess let me know the state of the union on the overall narrative? Are we sort of clear on it? Are we getting there? Do we have a pipeline of a younger generation that actively wants to participate in ways that maybe mine has not?
Well, I guess it depends on where you are. So half my family's, my mom's side of the family's from a little town in Iowa, a farming community that's barely there anymore. And yet they're, even though they've moved terribly right as a state, they're still really actively engaged in environmental issues because they're, once they realized their soil had degenerated from this farming community, and you know, they became super open to how to save it. And maybe they wouldn't call themselves green necessarily, but they're relying on green technologies and people like Earth Day and other organizations that will teach them how to save the place they love, and which gives them both a home and a family, life and income. So I think there's always something we can talk about in common. Now, if you were asking me a global question about the state of the world, it's pretty bad. I would rank plastic pollution and what it's doing to our bodies and possibly being the cause of untold number of deaths and illnesses already, never mind what it's doing to our wildlife and our oceans. You know, I would say that, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle. But do we have the resources, the wherewithal? We don't have the political will, but we have those resources available to us if we can fix it. I do think the enormous world population and the amount of greed in the world, where so few people have so much income, that I would, you know, say that we're in a place that's, you know, we're hampered by the lack of funding for these initiatives, because if they weren't so expensive, I think we'd find more people in agreement. But we're constantly presented with this. I saw a commercial last night on television, which was an ad for dumping anything to do with green. And it was, I don't even know who did the ad, because it gave me such a headache I had to walk away, but which I've been doing a lot lately when it comes to the news. But it basically was an ad about killing the environmental agenda because it costs more money. And people are really sensitive to money right now, even if the economy appears to be doing better. I don't know about you, but I'm still shocked when I go to the grocery store and the shrinking size of food. I mean, you get less food for more money. It's just incredible how they manage to do that to us. And I also think, as a general rule, we all, myself included, often feel powerless to do anything about it, whether it's the marketing of crappy food or giving us a false opinion about climate change or plastics or some of the major things that are really, you know, coming right down the pike, like right directly at us. And Because for the same reason, two reasons. One, people love the status quo. We all hate,
there's comfort,
unless you're really dumb, you all
right?
Hate change, right? We hate change. We hate it. We like to be stable. We're familiar with things. And so a lot of things can upset us and upset the equilibrium. And I think the other thing is we just want to live our lives, right? We don't want to be wrapped up necessarily in a flag, whatever color the flag is, all the time. Now, there's a subset of people, a growing one, that's bought into this idea that, you know, the left is really bad or the right is really bad or whatever. And they're loud and vocal, and we're all inundated with you know, social media, the news. I'm like literally going cold turkey. I'm trying so hard not to watch the news at all.
And isn't that part of the challenge, Kathleen, is that we want to learn about where the conversation is productive and these, right, in these different sort of storylines. But if it's becoming so convoluted, now we're then turning off, right, sort of the proverbial switch. And then we're not learning from what other people are doing. I'm wondering if you see pockets around the world where they're exceptional in their efforts and their storytelling around environmental issues and an environmental movement. I would contend in my travels to the Nordics repeatedly that that is a region that I have been. I mean, each time I'm there, I am so pleasantly surprised that it doesn't take a formal event to talk about sustainability. And the environment. I mean, it is something that is discussed while you're waiting for a trolley. It is there when you're getting a coffee, you're on a boat. It does not matter or time of day, event. I always hear them talking about it. And it's generationally agnostic as well. Young people, the elderly, middle-aged folks, they're all talking about it. Do you find that as well as sort of a hotbed of what we might aspire to be like as a nation in thinking about our impact on planet Earth?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you're absolutely right about Nordic countries. I mean, they have a certain amount of homogeneous population in many regards, although they do have immigrants there. And they have a long history because of where they live and the weather and everything else of being involved in nature. And you know, you have a country like Norway, for example, which is so super sustainable, but they make all their money from oil. So it's a little hard to reconcile that. They're a very generous country, but it's oil money. And so there's this, so I 100% agree with you in many of these countries that they're much more focused and open to sustainable living, and they don't have and don't want as much stuff as the US wants. Like, I'm not a stuff person. I've never been a stuff person. And so, so many people I know in my life are like, I have a set of dishes and I've had them for a long time and they look perfectly nice, and other people just give them away or chuck them out and buy new stuff. We have a throwaway culture here that makes a conversation about sustainability really difficult if we're being plied endlessly with commercials and pressure to have the latest stuff or the fast fashion or whatever it is. And it makes for the conversation, instead of being about, let's work to preserve this earth because we have kids and we want them to be okay, it becomes about, it sounds like the environmental community saying, you know, you should want less and you should live conservatively and you should not be using up the world's resources because it isn't fair. And all that might be true, but that doesn't really resonate with people who have been subjected to and then finally succumb to this idea of the more stuff and money you have, the better off you are. So
is there a path, Kathleen, maybe where we can see some progress? I think about young people and the education around environmental issues, but in particular, social impact, investing in entrepreneurship, I'm seeing so many young people that are looking at starting businesses and participating in ways that are, I think, thoughtful from a career perspective, but also encompassing of the planet and this social impact layer of interest from young people. I'm going to be speaking at a high school here in a few weeks in Nashville, and it's all about the social impact and being an entrepreneur around the world. Are you seeing that as an opening, as an opportunity to meld the two? Because it feels like it has been an either or. Either you are all the way in, to your point, sort of wrapped in a flag, and that can be exhausting and all consuming, or you're not, and then you're sort of branded as, you know, this, I don't even know, self-entitled, you know, sort of this entitled individual that is a part of the throwaway culture. How do you think about education when it comes to the business world, but more in particular, social impact and the way in which we're looking at entrepreneurism as maybe a runway to get the next generation on board?
Yeah, well, I think that there are two parts to that question. Is one, are young people, which they're generally young people are predisposed to be more open and ready to embrace things. And, you know, it was true in the 70s, I guess, when Dennis Hayes started Earth Day. That was the anti-war thing and the civil rights movement and the indigenous rights movement. All this stuff was happening in the 60s and 70s. And because the Vietnam War was so personal, right? Because people were getting drafted, they all became very engaged. And so you saw a huge number of them get engaged in the environmental movement. And you see young people, I was like that, I'm sure you were like that, much more open and ready to break the rules, to be different, to get involved. And then, so yes, I'm seeing that. I think there is a certain amount, I think it's overblown, certain amount of fear that young people have about climate change, and that drives them. On the other hand, the U.S., the vast majority of people in the U.S., particularly young people, it's all driven by young people, are buying literally 10, 12, 15 times the number of clothes that we bought growing up.
Because so are you walking contradictions in that regard?
Yes. And so it's, they may be vegan, but they're going to one of these fast fashion stores and buying, you know, 20 shirts for $20 or whatever. And then they fall apart and they throw them out. And clothes are 6-8% of climate change. And they're full of dyes and pesticides and chemicals and plastics. And they all go in our landfill. So no, and I would be the first one to say there's no such thing as a perfect environmentalist. I am certainly an imperfect environmentalist. So I am an avid, probably pointless recycler and some other things and in my life that are very, very green. And then other things that are not so green. So you have to cut everybody some slack. I do think the plastic and climate imperatives are growing. How that plays out in terms of consumption or entrepreneurism remains to be seen. But I am one of those people that believes that the combination of human beings getting engaged and business are the two things, and entrepreneurism and invention and innovation, those two things, youth and the people coming up are the ones that are, and business are going to solve climate change, not governments. We're just too wedded to that status quo and political outcomes to do anything really great. And I read an interesting article, and I know a lot of people that work there, BlackRock, which is, I think, the biggest investment fund in the world or whatever it is. It's kind of fund. And they've dropped a whole bunch of things related to ESG, environment and sustainability. But at the same time, without saying anything, they're revving up their investments in green. I mean, doubling, tripling, quadrupling their investments in green without talking about it. And that was a story in the Wall Street Journal, which is not exactly the most progressive paper on the planet. And but it is absolutely true that business will be dependent on young people and people coming up through the ranks to do two things. One is to be the innovators, since most innovation comes from inside companies, not outside them. And the second thing is they're going to need green consumers. And so I think you're seeing younger people much more tuned in to what they're eating. They're really worried about what they're eating. That message has gotten through. They're worried about climate. They're starting to get worried about plastics. And they all want to, or many of them want to be engaged in industries that are clean. So I think you've got all these really neat, really new dynamics working that weren't there when I was growing up. I wanted to be in news, or I wanted to be in, if I wanted to be anything, I wanted to be in the center of where the action was. And most kids are like that. They don't want to think of themselves as ending up as fast food workers for their whole lives or whatever. They, when you're young, you have endless possibilities. And so green and transitioning to a green economy or carbon-free economy gives us endless opportunities, because we have to rethink everything, everything. We have to rethink
endless.
100%. The chair I'm sitting on, the screen, the plastics, the energy, it's going to happen. And so if you have to rethink everything, and kids, like the people you're going to go talk to, they're ready to be inspired, and they need more mentoring for sure, in schools and out of schools, for what are their career possibilities. Because, and it's true, not just in the United States, it's true everywhere in the world. Amazingly smart people around the world that, given the opportunity, will be innovators. And you see that with all the prizes I'm involved in, where these teams from impossible places, difficult places, where they don't even have pencils or computers in school, are coming up with amazingly useful inventions that, I don't know why I didn't think of it, you know, but they're just so inventive and amazing. I had one kid, I think they won, I can't remember, I've been on the whole prize for a long time, that invented, it's from a college, it was a college, but it was a college nobody's ever heard of. And it was a poor college, a community college in India. And he and his classmates in this very poor college came up with and invented, created and built and showed up at this competition with a solar medical backpack that even worked for defibrillators and dental equipment. And they created this backpack, and it all fit on someone's back that could go to villages and bring life-saving technology. You had to have somebody carrying it, the new medical stuff, obviously. But I was shocked by their ability to literally create out of nothing a solution to a problem in the Himalayas or whatever, wherever they were working, where people just don't have access to anything. So
in the West, Kathleen, and if I'm hearing you correctly, and when you were talking a little bit earlier about sort of what has gotten through to young people, right? So it's eating healthy and these sort of these different parts of the story or puzzle pieces. I'm wondering if there's a chasm between sort of what's impacting me, sort of the larger me or us, and the impact we have on others, right? So like, we'll talk about digital footprints, a professional footprint, like how you impact, you know, your professional environment, those sorts of things. And I'm just wondering if that's the next frontier, which is to say, am I recycling? Like, you know, am I being a hypocrite, or am I not at least aligned in sort of my own personal mission and vision if I'm a vegan, but yet I am sort of, you know, ripping through clothes like nobody's business because that meets another need that I have socially, yet that's counterintuitive to a world where I'm trying to protect or be at least aware of the environment and the impact that I have on that environment.
Yeah, and that's what goes back to this imperfect environmentalist stuff. You know, people are environmentalists for lots of reasons. They don't have money, right? So they can't buy meat. It's too expensive. They don't have money for clothes. They take public transportation so they can say, hey, I don't have a car, you know? And that's true for a lot of urban dwellers, but who are very proud of the fact that they don't drive. But the truth is they can't afford it, and there's no place to park, but skipping that. So everybody, but if you recognize, and I think this is the point about Earth Day, if you recognize that what they're doing is a contribution, then maybe they'll do something else. And I think that's the transition that everybody should get a pat on the back, because even if it turns out to be either for a selfish reason, right? I want to be a vegan because I want to be healthy, but I love wearing clothes, or necessity because I don't have money for a car or meat or anything else. All of those people get a prize, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is save what's remaining of our world's resources for our kids and grandkids. And that feels far away, but for a lot of people, especially for young people, but you know, nobody's perfect. And so that imperfection is actually valuable, because they eventually will run into the conflict or the incongruity of being a vegan but spending their life income on clothes. And again, nobody should be you know, punished for not being perfect. I think if you point out how great it is to people that they are able to live a vegan lifestyle, because for a million reasons, I mean, so many reasons, and eventually they're going to be open to and hear these other messages. Now, that's not to say, going back to who's going to save the planet, it's not to say that people in business are going to save the planet, because you need the government in there for regulation. I mean, the Fast Fashion Act, which is floating around in the New York legislature, would be amazingly, it's a law that requires everybody to identify where everything came from and what their impacts are, et cetera, et cetera. It's going through various forms, probably won't pass, but it's the first time there's been anything in New York, which is one of the fashion capitals of the planet, where they put the burden on the manufacturers to come clean about where they get their stuff and what the impact is. And so there's a huge role for government, which means youth, in addition to their own lives of vegan versus buying a bunch of clothes, the most important thing in a democracy is that they vote for the people who are going to help them achieve a stable and prosperous and healthy planet, right? And that part, I think the environmental community is still not doing a great job convincing people that youth vote, which is always terribly low, even when Obama ran, it was low. You know, there's this old myth around a lot of that, and for good reason. But the important thing is, or political leaders, right? So if you're right, you asked me, the political leader part came up. We were talking about this, where we are right now. But the future largely depends on all three agencies, so to speak. We're all agents, the public, meaning me and you, our kids, governments, and strong governments with the right reasons and a plan, and business. Because no matter what we do, business wants to make money, right? Their end game is profit, 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 profit. And they might play a game around being green, and some of them are actually honest, but really the reality, and I've been doing this for a long time, is their goal is money. So where I see business playing a role is in the innovation to make money, because if they can't make money on green technology, then they're not going to do it. They're just not in the business to lose money. So that's another place young people can have impacts inside companies that they end up working for. Whether it's at UPS, UPS is a great example where, well, you know, they, a lot of the innovation has been driven by their drivers and other people. And other companies have really responded to people inside their companies being innovators. So it's a very complex web of issues. But I do think, going back to your question, young people are going to have to solve the problems that we've left them to deal with. I mean, they just are. If we're going to be out of something in 2050, I'm not going to be alive, right? Or I'm not going to be active or whatever. I'm not going to be out in the streets then. And when you have longer term projected goals and objectives, you know, like my kids will be older then too, and they'll be relying on their grandkids to get it together. And that's always been the case. I do think we're going through this crazy retrenchment worldwide where we're swinging right. It's not just the US, we're swinging right in, I think 103 countries are holding elections. And if you look at who's running, there's a pretty good chance you'll have some pretty conservative people running. And I think that happens, you know, you two steps forward, one step back. And I view, you know, all of these things as playing out in different ways. But I do think in calling myself a progressive, it's about progress. It's about solving climate change. It's about getting plastics out of the placentas of our infants. It's just so stunning to me that 100% of fetal placentas are full of plastic. I don't know if you saw that report a couple of days ago. 100% of them.
It's very scary. Kathleen, I want to, as we put a bow on this conversation, I want to make sure that people can,
but we have enough time to, yes,
can learn more about how to participate with Earth Day. Where should they go in advance of Earth Day coming up next month?
Well, they can come to our website, earthday.org. It's easy to find things to do, signing petitions, organizing cleanups, planting trees, downloading education materials. I mean, we spend a lot of our lives, I mean, we work year round on plastics and fashion and climate education are all big things that we work on, but we're the sort of, you know, organization that runs and gets Earth Day off the ground every year. And so it takes up a lot of our time. So we spend a lot of staff resources and work with, you know, over 100,000 other groups to come up with the kinds of things that we should have on our website that are useful to everybody. So we have everything from books you can read to a brand new baby that you just want to read to how to put on a swap of used clothing. If you want to, and you're in college campuses, we teach kids how to create swaps so they can not spend money on new clothes, but get something new, to major giant cleanups around the world. Political activism. We work with thousands of mayors to get them to make more audacious and higher level commitments than they ordinarily would in honor of Earth Day. So we try to get everybody into the act. We have, I know, Pope Francis always does something on Earth Day. And he's been a huge supporter, and lots of other religious organizations do around Earth Day, because it's in so many ways common sense. And I don't care what religion you're from, none of them talk about let's destroy the joint as part of their rituals. So they're all in the business of saving what God created and in their view. And there's a lot of harmony around that. And there's so much opportunity around Earth Day for peace. I mean, one thing I'd love, I know you have viewers, I mean, listeners, and, you know, we've always done issues for Earth Day. We've done plastics and biodiversity, and you sort of name it, we've done it. We've done pollinators when they were like, it was a hot issue and we wanted to broadcast it. And, but there's a part of me for our 55th anniversary, which is next year, that wants to figure out a way, if any of your listeners have ideas, on how to bring peace and reconciliation in this incredibly war-torn world. It's stunningly bad right now. And whether you're talking, it doesn't matter where you're talking about, whether you're talking about cartels killing candidates running for mayor. I mean, it's just like day after day after day, there's so much violence and anger. And I would love to see the 55th anniversary of Earth Day be about reconciliation, about how do we stop talking about all the issues and just, can we all agree on one thing, that the planet we depend on is worth saving? And even if we have different ideas about how we go about doing that, which we obviously do. I mean, people don't want to give up anything, many people, to save the planet, but they would if they really understood it. But if we could come together, and so that would be a really different theme for the 55th anniversary. I have no idea what the politics of that would be, but I think about it all the time, because having done this for a long time and worked in litigation and lobbying and all the other stuff where you're really out there just shoving and pushing people around and trying to get them to do what you want, in a very nice way, I must say, that you, that there has to be some moment where, since a billion people are doing Earth Day, that if we all really got into the act of trying to create a uniform vision for the planet, that shared resources, that maybe we could lessen, I'm not saying fix, but lessen or tamp down or dilute the rhetoric. I suspect, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the election, but I suspect, you know, if things go the way, who knows what's going to happen, but we may see, not just in the US, but other places, an absolute 180 degree turn and people walking away from the environment. And it will be temporary, because Mother Nature has this habit of making things.
It will be
present.
It'll be temporary, but your voice and that of Earth Day are not. And you have done an incredible job, and you bring such great energy to the conversation, which I think is very, very important, to maintain substance around these topics and meaning for people, not just sort of where they work and where the communities that they live in, but their own sort of person, their personhood, their constitution. I think that's important. I want to encourage people to check out earthday.org. Like Kathleen said, there's so many ways that you can engage and educate not just yourself, but the classrooms that you teach, the families that you occupy, and the communities that you're working and striving to support. We want to thank our host, our guest, I should say. See, you were you in the conversation, even Kathleen. I was sitting there, almost called you the host. I want to thank Kathleen Rogers. She's the president of earthday.org. Again, you can go to earthday.org to learn more about Earth Day 2024, which takes place on April 22nd. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger.
This concludes another chapter of On Balance. Connect with me via LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Dr. Rod Berger.